Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming. How many of y'all were here yesterday? Raise your hand. Okay, so I'm going to do a brief introduction for those of you who weren't. This is a series on breaking out of status quo, breaking out of cycles, systemic change. I call it different things depending on my mood and the time of day. And let me just give you a roadmap to where we are or where we've been. I don't know. Is it good, Jan, to show people what we did last week? They just make them feel bad.
Make them stay longer, Holden.
There you go. Hey, come on in. Sit in place. We're here in week two. And last week we talked about, in general, this concept of how the status quo perpetuates itself in cycles and ideas of how we might break out of those cycles. We skipped this one. We did asset-based community development, and we talked about place-based action, urbanness, ruralness, suburbanness. And we did a change clinic, which I'll talk about in a second. Yesterday we did a reintroduction, and we moved this one to this week. We had Renaissance last week, so we didn't have five sessions. So today we're doing institutional dynamics, roles, and accountability. And we switched the order of these because it made more sense if you're coming to all of them. So that tomorrow we'll be talking about church-based action, and Thursday, money and markets, economic development, those kinds of things. And we'll do another change session, change clinic on Friday. The change clinic is where we act as kind of group consultants to each other and try to use some of these ideas to create some possible solutions and some hope for folks within our own group. How many folks were at Jan's thing this morning? Bible study. And you, Jan. And, man, it was just one of those things where on Monday I said that teaching here has been such a joy, partly because of what I've gotten from you all, and partly because of the weaving together of the different classes. And serendipitously, unplanned, if not by accident, Jan's discussion of Bible stories this morning was all about institutional dynamics. In many ways, I mean, that's part of what it was about. There is this deal of temple Judaism and the power structure within the society that Jesus lived in, and the lesson from Mark was about how he came in and turned over the money-changing tables and the dove-selling tables in the temple and said, my temple is to be a house of prayer, and you've turned it into a den of robbers. And why all of that? And the discussion went to how the temples had become institutionalized and how they had become actually a source of financial transactions, so that these money-changing tables were for people to change their Roman money into Jewish money when they come into the temple because they're not allowed to have the graven image, and somebody's taking a cut for that. And then the doves were actually for sale for people to sacrifice. What's that doing in the temple? I don't get that at all. But anyway, they're making money off of that as well. And so they had a structure, a hierarchy, in which the temples were serving the economic interests of a select group of folks, priests and Levites and what are these Sadducees? I don't even know how much I know about
Pharisees
and Sadducees. Sadducees.
Not Pharisees.
Sadducees. And so they had kind of a life of their own. And when Jesus came and knocked over all this stuff and said, "This is not what's written," the priests said, "How do we kill this guy?" Right? But the crowds were jubilant and astonished and blown away and supportive of all of this. Somewhere there in the evolution of this temple system, the institution had grown apart from its constituency. Because apparently, there were some people who still wanted to believe in the life of that institution, and the folks that the institution is supposed to be there for in the first place were happy when it was being knocked over. And, junior high school teacher, what's your name again?
Kathleen.
Kathleen had two wonderful comments. Let me see if I can. One of them was about the wisdom and the will becoming institutionalized. Do you remember?
It's
the way you put it was beautiful. I don't know if you'll ever get that back, but it was.
I asked you to repeat it later.
She couldn't do it.
It's on tape.
It's on tape. Hey, let's go back and look it up. That's imaginative. But basically, Jesus had said, you call this wisdom when all this is against the writings. So the idea that what was wisdom became institutionalized, and it became truth because it was heard over and over again in the temple, and it became part and parcel of what it meant to be in the temple, was the first comment that came. Okay. And the second one was just as interesting. And that had to do with security. You remember that? I'm sorry, I'm picking on you, but it was really great. And you don't feel bad about that. She's always like that?
No. Yes, she is.
That was a trick.
To be secure, I try and institutionalize my safety. No matter how much God says, that's not me, and you can't institutionalize me. I am creator, constantly creating. I keep trying to institutionalize so that my world would be predictable and I can be safe.
Here's what you said, my dependable, and it was secure and safety, but if there's a sense that it will continue on, that it will have a life of its own. Oh, I love that. Both of these things are all about institutional dynamics. I'm a community economic developer, and I've spent all my life working in, for, and by nonprofit, grassroots community organizations, one kind or another. One that you might know of is Bethel New Life, which is now one of the nation's largest community development corporations, which means it has a budget of $7 million or something like that, which is a lot. Or a little, depending on your perspective. And what's unusual about it is that it is a spin-off or an affiliate of a Lutheran church, the Bethel Lutheran Church, and that church is located in and its congregation consists of low-income African Americans living in West Garfield Park on the west side of Chicago. Can somebody get the door for me? So, what we found as the point of this whole class has been that we were doing things that when I talked to bank executives or talked to my peers and colleagues or talked to folks in church groups, folks would call miraculous. And not unlike stories that Jonathan talked about of hope and perseverance against incredible odds in third world countries. And people would always ask me, can we make a difference? Does this stuff work? And I began to think about how we can make a difference and why that's such an important question and how we do, in fact, make a difference in so many different parts of our lives. And the idea of this whole class is that the hope that we get from making change in one part of our life creates action in others by inspiring them, and in ourselves by the knowledge of what it takes to make change and break out of cycles. so that it isn't just a foreign thing that's happening in a third world country or an inner city community, or even in an esoteric profession like community economic development, but that we're all working as agents of change all the time, and that our experience as individuals with change gives us understanding about change in other situations, and together we make a big loop of hope and action. We replace negative cycles of perpetuation of bad status quos with a positive cycle of hope and action. And in the course of my work as a community economic developer, we ran into a lot of stuff about institutionalization. Here's a story about institutional roles that I just give to you, to give you an example. Sometime in the mid to late 70s, a housewife, a woman named Gail Sincotta, who lived in Austin, which is just actually the community just to the west of West Garfield Park in Chicago, she started to feel the impact of government and business programming. It wasn't one or the other. There were failures in what they call FHA mortgage guarantee programs in her community. What that basically meant was that the government was giving out subsidized mortgages to folks to buy homes in her community, and those were failing. There wasn't somehow follow-up, there wasn't a good structure of the program, and so those homes would then be abandoned and boarded up. And this would give a bad visual, physical impression to the community, and banks and insurance companies then would refuse to lend in that area. They would have a big map, and they would draw a red line around the area and say, that's a ghetto, that's a slum, that's where black people live, and we're not going to lend there. And that was called redlining. So she got organized with people in her own community in Austin, and then later citywide, and later nationally, formed an organization called National People's Action. And they got angry and went and protested the offices of FHA, of banks, and of insurance companies. One of the outcomes of that organizing was the creation of a new law governing banks. There were also new laws governing insurance companies, and there were new programs that were coming out of insurance companies. But the one governing banks is called, who knows what that's called, banks having to reinvest in their communities. Have you heard of this? Shit, it's pretty important. It's called the Community Reinvestment Act. And the principle that a bank taking deposits out of a community ought to then reinvest those funds in that community, and that was what's not happening in redlining. They weren't redlining deposits, but we won't make loans in that area. We'll be happy to take your deposits in that area, right? And there was a federal law created that said that banks had to do that, and there was some informal, really, enforcement mechanisms that basically had to do with giving banks a scorecard for how they were doing on community reinvestment. Community organizations were given the opportunity to comment on the bank's scorecard. And when that would become important would be if a bank sold or merged, which they started to do with some regularity. So the opportunity to intervene in banks came in the mid-80s. Meanwhile, alternative institutions, namely these community development corporations, nonprofit organizations owned, run by, for the members of a community, usually low-income, grassroots communities, mostly people of color, they had formed to provide, to fill the gap, to provide the housing and other kinds of investments in communities that the big institutions had abandoned. Redlined. So, for example, at Bethel New Life, when it formed, I think it was 1981 or something like that, and just rehabbed the house with using the credit cards of the members of the church, it was the first housing rehab that had been done in that community in 20 years. And when new construction was done 5 years later, it was the first new construction that had been done in 25 years. And these CDCs got so that they knew the housing industry because they did it. they did rehab, they did need construction, they knew how to put financing together, they knew how to manage construction, they knew about units and market rents and subsidy levels and that sort of thing. And because they were controlled by community folks, oftentimes the same folks who'd be down there protesting the banks and the insurance companies, they knew then where the gaps were in the lending. So when the banks and the insurance companies said, we can't lend for housing in that community, it's uneconomical, it can't be done, there were the CDCs to say, uh-huh, you're wrong, because we're doing it. So that popped that bubble, right? So then what happened was you had cooperation between the organizers, the Gale Sincadas, and the developers like Mary Nelson, the leader of Bethel New Life, to together go down to the downtown banks, the First National Bank, Continental Bank, and the Northern Trust, all of which have since been sold and are under new names. And when they decided to do a merger, or they were buying some other companies, and their CRA, Community Investment Act, record was up for review, the community groups came in and said, we're going to protest, we're going to file a complaint about this, and that'll hold up your merger. And we're going to file a complaint because we know what your redlining history is, and we also know how to do it. We know that it can be done, that housing can be developed in these communities. So, because it was cheaper for them to do this than to lose the merger, these banks capitulated and created neighborhood lending programs, which basically said that they were going to lend for housing and also for commercial and sometimes industrial real estate development in low-income communities. Okay? So that new loans would be available, and they created new little departments called their neighborhood lending departments, new little advertising campaigns, and new little new ways of doing underwriting that would allow them to do this in ways that they couldn't before because they said it was impossible. So that was the mid-80s. The late 80s and in the early 90s, they actually ran these programs. And in Chicago, it was about $250 million in commitments from these three banks. Lo and behold, they were very successful. Lo and behold, the banks found that they tapped new markets that they didn't even dream were there. Lo and behold, they found that they made money on those loans. That the people who borrowed money to build a house or to rehab an apartment in a low-income community could be great credit risks, especially compared to what were the banks lending to in the 80s, you know, speculative stuff in Brazil, right? That written on a napkin, remember all the savings and loans stuff, right? So, they became centerpieces of the bank's programs. And they started to brag about them, and they started to feel good about them. And the bank presidents would go to civic committee meetings and say, doing good can also make money. And so then the Community Reinvestment Act law came up for came up for another 5 years. Sunsetted legislation, I think they call it. And who's going down there to lobby for it? Well, Gale Sincada's back there again. But with her are the presidents of First National Bank and Continental Bank and the Northern Trust and their counterparts in banks across the country to say, we're in favor of this because we know it can work. So to me, that's an example of institutional dynamics. And one way, and kind of a form that we can think about when we think about how can institutions change. Let me carry this to the kind of format that we've been using this this week when we talk about cycles of change. All right, so this is institutional self-perpetuation, okay? Now you can be the temples in Jerusalem, or you could be the banks in Chicago, or you could be social service agencies in Spokane, you could be a Holden Village, you could be any kind of institution, doesn't matter. But I'm suggesting that there's this kind of pattern at work in every institution. Okay, is it hard to read?
No.
Can somebody kill that, right? light.
Luther.
Yes.
Music stand.
Okay, good.
Perfect.
Okay, can most people see that? Is it mostly focused? You know, I just never have been able to get this to be really sharp here. Okay, well, let's start off on the left. The institution produces valuable stuff, whatever that is. That's where it starts out. It could start out small over here. Okay? It could be a company. It could be a school. It could be one of these banks. Okay? And they require inputs to work. And those inputs could be materials and labor for a company that produces widgets. It could be parishioners and buildings for the temples. It could be deposits and loans for customer patronage for a bank. Then, in order to do its business, the institution has to organize to control those inputs. That's banks redlining. And that's when the money changers start to make some money. They start to say, well, we're the ones who determine, you know, changing of the coins, so we're going to be the ones who do the money changing, or the dove selling, or whatever it is. And so, what's sold at the temple, what's done in the temple, what's transacted in the office of the bank, is the stuff that the institution says is valuable. And that's what people recognize. So the institutionally appropriate stuff is valued and accessed. But there is a kind of a mindset then that develops within this institution that says you can't loan in this community. That it is part of our wisdom to do money changing in the temple. And, well, then that supports the institution producing those valuable things. Over time. All right, I'm going to turn that off and just bring this back up. So that wisdom, what is valued? I don't know if I'm going to jump up and down. Can you all see this? Yes? Okay. So comment number one here, wisdom is institutionalized. Okay? It was conventional wisdom that you can't lend in a low-income community. It was conventional wisdom that money changing in the temple was appropriate. Let me read from, I read this one from Ellen Willis yesterday. I didn't get a chance to emphasize part of it. This is the woman who I read that talked about working outside the system, a radical left in politics. No mass left-wing movement has ever been built upon a majoritarian strategy. On the contrary, every such movement has begun with a visionary minority whose ideas were at first decried as impractical, ridiculous, crazy, dangerous, and/or immoral. By definition, the conventional wisdom of the day is widely accepted, continually reiterated in cycles, and regarded not as ideology, but as reality itself. Rebelling against reality, even when its limitations are clearly perceived, is always difficult, not crazy. Right? So within the banks, there is this conventional wisdom. And it is because the bank has a need to exist that it controls its own perspective in a way that teaches its members, its practitioners, its participants, a certain worldview. And that worldview is accepted because it's part of what makes the institution important. Now, notice one thing here. I always have to make this clear. Nowhere in here does it say evil people do something. Right? Now, it may be that those priests were evil, really. It may be that they weren't. This all happens for a good reason, for the institution producing valuable stuff. Right? And so we've seen it. In community organizing in Chicago, gosh, a new community group or a new coalition of community groups comes up, you know, every month. Just amazing to me. And how many times I've talked to people who want to start a new organization, and they always have a good reason for it. And it's a reason that, you know, you could never tell them that it wasn't a good reason. And it usually is no reason to tell them that it isn't. But eventually, what happens is the thing takes on a life of its own. And so when that happens, then there is a balance, if not a conflict, between the life of the institution itself and what it does to perpetuate its own life and its original mission and the interests of the constituency, customers, members, citizens, or whatever that it was formed to create in the first place. That could take a year, it could take 100 years. It could be when it reaches 7 million or 700 million in budget or 7,000 in budget. But it is a process that we have to know about and remember because it means that institutions created for good reasons can at some point undermine their own reasons for being. Okay, we're going to do a group process and we're going to come back and talk about ways to break out of that. What I would like you to do, let's do, did trios feel good to you yesterday? Those of you who were here? Let's do trios. I like that. It's more than two, it's less than a big group. And I want you to talk in a group about situations that you know of where an institution, in order to protect its life, to feed itself, has started to grow away from its mission and from its constituency. Institution, any organization, and it usually means people are making money, where there's some kind of a budget, and people are being paid a salary, because there's something else called an association, and I think that's a different kind of an animal. So it could be a business, could be a nonprofit organization, could be a government agency. And I want you to just brainstorm some examples of that. If you can get one for each person in the group, like we tried to do last time, that's good. Or if you can feed off of each other to generate two or three for each group, that would be good. And you did. About 10 minutes now, okay? We're coming back now. How was that? Did you come up with some? Completely foreign concept or something you're able to apply in many situations? Well, all right, how about an example? Somebody give me an example. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'm giving you the mother's version, so I may have some of the
facts. But it's going to have perspective in it.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a daughter that's an actuary for an insurance company, and one of the things she's been doing this year is traveling to Chicago, Philadelphia, Cleveland. We're from Seattle. And I didn't realize before, until she talked to me about it, that I think the federal government has said that the insurance companies now have to deal in the central area.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And she's a very liberal gal, but she says, Mom, they took their cars into these areas, and she said, it's not only money, like you were talking about, but it's also fear. So I think we have to work on that because the insurance agents were asked to come in the past, and the gangs were there, and they freaked out. So
okay.
That's also another element that you're dealing with. Now, in Seattle this year...
Wait a minute. Let me stop you. Just understand. Fear, meaning that the insurance companies were asking or recruiting or trying to place agents, insurance agents, offices in inner city communities, and individuals who could have been agents in those offices were afraid to work there because of the crime. Is that right?
Well,
is that what you're saying?
That would be the goal, to put the offices in the community. That is the goal. That's one of the answers. But they weren't in the community. I understand that they were on the outside of the communities, and they're required to come in to assess.
Yes.
And they didn't have the background to deal with what they found and the fears. So now in Seattle, I don't know what's happening in the other cities. She said they are training black people to carry those jobs so that they can have an office that will be more sympathetic for both the people living there and their working in that area. Did I make myself clear?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I'm going to phrase it this way, see if that's fair. Insurance agent firm outside the community were afraid to work inside the community.
That's right.
There's a little bit of a vicious circle there.
Mm-hmm.
We want to work the insurance agent from inside the community in the first place.
Because they haven't been trained.
Okay.
So,
so this is what they were trying to do. When you say training, training people who live in the community to be insurance agents.
That's right.
Rather than training insurance agents from outside the community not to be afraid.
Right.
Okay, good. Another another example. How about back here?
You talked about the American older American car industry.
Okay. Why is that an example?
Well, they basically were an institution that was unchallenged in the world for quite a while until the Japanese came around and decided to make something that was probably more user-friendly, and the American car industry didn't believe it until all of a sudden they lost sales to the Japanese.
That's kind of key. They didn't believe it. Why didn't they believe it? When the Japanese produced a better car, a car that
because they've been doing it for so much longer, and well, highly institutionalized in the sense that they didn't have input from probably from their customers.
General Motors is, was the biggest company in the world, right? So they were pretty big and pretty high up there in the corporate executive offices from there down to the ground. Yeah.
Right after World War II, made in Japan was synonymous for cheap and junk.
Yeah.
So if American companies would have thought of competing with this sort of kind of shoddy sort of things that came out in the 50s right after the war.
Right. So it caught them unawares. But there was a conventional wisdom then that developed, and the conventional wisdom was part Japanese is shoddy, and it was part we know what we're doing because we've been doing it for years and we're the biggest company in the world. So, this another example.
We talked about public schools where it seemed like the input was constant, the product dubious, but because the input students keep coming, there's less motivation or ability or somehow to fix the product, even though there seems to be growing dissatisfaction. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So that's kind of similar to the automakers in that sense that they were unchallenged.
Okay,
the church is what now? Are we talking about an individual congregation or the ELCA or like all religious institutions in the world or what?
Sure.
She's a computer programmer, see? She thinks in systems and it really doesn't matter what the scale. What did you have in mind? So you can get a picture of it.
Specifically, I was thinking about neighborhood churches focusing on trying to get more young people into the church, people my age. Tendency is to then things like dumbing down the liturgy, moving away from Bible study and more towards social activities, and moving away from mission work. Those kinds of things probably do draw in some youth. They don't draw me in. But they also have a tendency to take the church away from core values that the church is built upon in the first place.
Yeah. That's kind of a strategy for change as opposed to the institutionalization in the first place, I think. And I kind of put it over here in the co-opting thing, and we'll kind of get to that at the end. But there must have been some kind of institutionalization thing happening that the neighborhood church lost the young people in the first place, maybe. So maybe that's an example. All right, come on. I need one or two more examples here. Yes, sir.
The ELCA has a church-wide, one church-wide appeal, it's the hunger appeal. And it started 25 years ago, and it's a good thing. But I think it may not have noticed a certain lack of confidence in the central church body. People vote with their dollars, and they keep most of their dollars in their local communities. And so this critical area is suffering from its association with an institution that has slipped, I think, in the estimate of the people. I'm not sure about that.
I think we talked about that also, but in a such larger context,
yeah.
Insofar as we talked about local congregations in Lutheran or Methodist or Presbyterian or whatever, really not seeing their national church as being somehow connected to them. It's something up and beyond, and not anything you need to really pay attention to, whereas it's right there in your home congregation, your immediate community, that your focus is.
And you have a kind of a paradox between the abstraction of the headquarters and the, I mean, what could be more immediate and compelling than hunger? So you've hung the kind of the key issue of life on a peg, which has drifted.
Right. Okay, good. One more?
Well, we talked about a church, or then we were talking about a committee, which could be in a church or another organization, that, well, let's just stick with the church, that experiences some kind of challenge, say, declining membership.
Yeah.
And so kind of reinforces itself to instead of looking at its mission and ministry, to kind of raise the Vulcan and say, well, we need enough money to pay the bills, and stops being focused on that original mission, or original reason for being of mission ministry.
Okay, they need enough money to pay the bills, and so they're thinking about that is,
Is
they're focused on money.
They're just focusing on institutional preservation instead of being in the mission and ministry.
All right. Okay, good. You notice in all these cases, both of these things happen, right? Both of your points. That there is this reason for this institution existing. And it may be, you know, permanence and security. In some ways, it's also about production. I mean, you need a big company to make automobiles, you know. There's a reason why the hunger appeal is national. A lot of money to be raised. Public schools are all centralized by city. Somebody thinks there's economies of scale in that. Teach a lot of kids, right? There are good reasons for all of that. And at the same time, in all the cases that I heard there's some kind of institutionalization of the conventional wisdom. So how do we break out of this cycle? And what cycle do we go to? That's kind of the next step of it. I'll propose a model to you based on that CRA thing, a community reinvestment thing that we talked about earlier, and see if this fits with some of your situations and some of your descriptions. I'm proposing this as a kind of a positive model of institutional dynamics, okay? And down here we have mainstream institutions. This is misspelled, another misspelling, whatever. But all this is relative, okay? So certainly Chrysler is a mainstream institution. It's hard to describe a neighborhood church as a mainstream institution unless you're thinking of it as the main production to a certain community constituency, okay? So in the case, in the example I brought in the beginning, these would be the banks, okay? The community constituency would be Gale Sincada, the National People's Action, okay? And then the alternative institutions here would be community development corporations. And what I'm proposing is that maybe there's a balance between these three things which can provide both the wisdom and the security in a new kind of a cycle. But I think of it this way, if this is an ocean liner. Well, an ocean liner is what you need to cross the ocean. And so lots of people can go on it and can get through the big choppy waters and it can do production. A bank is what you need to lend and deposit lots of money in an inner city community. Over here is an alternative institution, Bethel New Life, a community development corporation. We did 500 units of housing in 7 years, something like that. Tremendous number for a community development corporation. But then when you think about it, 30,000 people live just in West Garfield Park. And this is one of the largest community development corporations in the country. It's not an ocean liner. It's not going to produce at the same scale. It's not going to produce that long-term level of stability that people need. What it does provide to this mainstream institution is a sense of appropriateness, that it is possible to develop housing in this community, and here's how it can be done. And we can do it at Bethel New Life, where the for-profit housing developers didn't do it, because they were big and we were little. They were outside, we were inside, we were community-based, we were appropriate. We also created one of the first holistic community health centers. That was a big term for that in the 80s. It's kind of a little bit out of date now. The hospitals couldn't do that. Some discussion back here about HMOs, right? Hospitals weren't doing that. They were, you know, ask a doctor at the hospital, I don't work here, right? So we were able then to demonstrate some alternative approaches to healthcare. There were no, you know, there were fewer doctors per capita in West Garfield Park than there were in Bangladesh. So we had to do something different from what had been done there in the past. So there's a sense of appropriateness here that comes from alternative institutions. What was the other thing in that story about the relationship between Gale Sincada's organizations and organizers and these institutions? Well, in order to get these institutions to do anything different, they had to make a big noise. Right? Had to protest, had to organize, had to actually go to outside of the bank, go to the government and pass a law, the Community Reinvestment Act, that told them they had to do it. Right? That's the kind of accountability that the mainstream institutions have. It's not an easy accountability. But here, the relationship between the organizers and these alternative institutions is a much closer relationship. In some communities, there would be two. There would be the organizing group and the development group. And often the development group was a spin-off of the organizing group. And they might even have members of the same board of directors or even the same general membership. So the idea that the alternative institution would be somehow apart from the community constituency was just nonsensical. What the alternative institution provided to this constituency was something that could be accountable. So they could say, what we need is this kind of housing, and they could work on that as a model for appropriateness. And what the alternative institutions would provide to the constituency is that control, and what the constituency provides to the institution is the pulse. Right? The feeling of what it's needed in the community. The thing the big three missed, right? When they weren't in touch with their customers, right?
okay? Over here, this is one that's often missed. It's called legitimacy on here. I'm doing this as institutions, could be public sector, private sector, nonprofit. So a constituency is a general term, could be customers of this business, could be citizens or voters of a government. But it doesn't matter what it is, one way or the other, the life of the mainstream institution depends on legitimacy from the community constituency. The big three fell because they lost legitimacy with their customers. Their customers stopped believing the conventional wisdom. Their customers started believing these Japanese shoddy companies, right, could produce cars of a better quality than they were used to seeing from the big three, right? Same thing with these banks. These banks were taking deposits out of the community, and they required those deposits to exist, and they required that as a kind of a financial legitimacy, right? And they even needed to be able to say the First National Bank of Chicago, so they needed a sense that they were all of Chicago, right? And they couldn't get that from their consumers if they were protesting at their offices.
Question, Luther.
Yes, Jan.
Does it always need an alternative institution to be the lever to make this work?
Well, it's a proposal. It's a model. I'm suggesting that we think about it in terms of some of these dynamics that we've talked about here. And we're not going to have time to play it out here. I'm not saying this is the only way change can happen. I do think that, you know, I've seen people try to do change just within mainstream institutions. And if you go to the bookstore or the library and look at the management section, there are rows and rows of books about management improvements, and this one is based on Japanese warrior stuff, and this one is the seven effective habits, and this one is, you know. But what they all say is, you know, we're inside this mainstream institution, and we're going to try to be in tune with our customers, and we're going to try to be, you know, on top of it, and Series E, and so forth. But, you know, it's still an ocean liner. And you still don't want the ocean liner paddling around the harbor. You need a tugboat over here. And I think that there's something inherent in scale and constituency and accountability that a small alternative institution has the flexibility to be creative, the immediacy to get the information that it needs about changing trends and patterns, and the ability then to act on those without a great deal of risk and without a great deal of capital investment and personal and human social investment that makes it an appropriate agent for change without then sacrificing the security and long-term permanence of either the mainstream institution or the alternative institution.
It seems to me, in a way, it may be revealing the big three example. Once those big auto companies in the United States had realized that Japanese automakers were a serious threat to their profitability, they changed. That change took years and years and years and years. I'm not sure it's over with yet.
No.
But it took them many, many long, painful, agonizing years for institutions that large to change their patterns of doing things.
I was really interested that you all came up with three church examples, right? Neighborhood church dumbing down to attract young people, the ELCA itself, and the church with declining membership, thinking about money instead of mission. Because I couldn't think of what's an alternative institution to a neighborhood church.
Well, but I'm thinking about, say, the mainstream institution is the Lutheran Church, the alternative institution is Holden Village.
Okay.
So Holden wants to be an agent of renewal in the mainstream institutions. We were also talking about schools, mainstream institution, public school, charter schools,
right,
as these little,
sure,
and then bringing up the often heard argument, but if you get these devoted parents over here in the charter school, they're not doing anything for the mainstream institution. And then also saying, well, how come this alternative isn't influencing the mainstream yet? Maybe the piece that's not totally developed is up above this this constituency that's out there agitating, to say to the mainstream, look, this alternative model works, and we want it, and we think you have the capabilities to do it on a larger scale.
All three pieces have to be there. You know, in my business, the big fight is here and here, okay? These are the community organizers. I was talking to Dean yesterday about this. And these are the community developers, okay? And there's always a fight about which is more important or which is really the agent of change and that sort of thing. And people always come back down and say they're two sides of the same coin. Right? You can't do organizing without development. You can't do the development without organizing. And I guess I'm really saying they're three sides of the same, whatever, a three-sided thing, triangle, right? Right? That we do need these mainstream institutions, because they say, you don't produce enough. You can't have enough charter schools in the world, you know, to produce the education needs of our whole society. So we need the public schools here, but we do need alternative institutions to try out and to test different approaches and theories.
Yeah, is the alternative institution why the political system in this country continues to triangle between Democrats and Republicans? So that when you're in the your mainstream is right now, say, a Democratic president and a Republican Congress and Senate, but the promise is always the alternative institution is to elect the other parties back in?
Okay.
Then what would be, the alternative institution is the fear that there will be a successful third-party movement.
Okay, that's another possibility. Do you think that's really realistic that the third party would ever take hold?
Yes, I do. Because I think a lot of the current young generation, I hope, is sufficiently fed up with both parties equally. And I think Jesse Ventura, above and beyond his wrestling, is symbolic of that kind of attitude.
It still hasn't scared him. I mean, Ventura's popularity still hasn't scared anybody.
General Motors was not scared until, for how many years after that had happened?
They talk about it, and how it's changed things, but it's
also possible, let me just point out, that the alternative institution is not a party at all.
Yeah.
Or that it's... And it could be, community organizing. There was a guy here last week from the New Party in Missoula, and they're not really trying to be a third party as much as they are trying to organize around issues that people care about. Who cares about the party labels?
Well, sometimes in a congregation,
which
is the mainstream long-term congregation.
Okay.
You'll have a group or constituents that all no longer believe in its ideology.
Yeah.
And so what they will do within the congregation is form a separate mini-congregation, which is the alternative institution that continues to rival the mainstream institution, and then you can have wonderful church splits.
Or
sometimes there can be a group or even an individual that institutionalizes something in an alternative way, and all the people in the mainstream who say, oh no, you could never do that, or we've tried that, it didn't work, someone decides, well, shoot, we're going to feed the hungry in our community, and starts doing it, and everyone has to say, well, goodness, it works. And so then that on the scale of the whole congregation doing it is able to increase, and that becomes a viable, a good ministry based on the alternative institution of the one person of a small group who started that on a smaller scale.
And how many times has it happened that the people that were originally those that said that would never work, 10 years later remember themselves as being in the forefront of
change? Well, let me ask this question, especially of the group that said the neighborhood church with a declining membership focuses on money instead of mission. See, a church is a little different as an institution because there's not much paid staff there, right? It's what they call a voluntary association. Most of the work is volunteer. And I guess I was thinking that in some way in a church there's a trade-off between money and time of the members, right? I mean, you can hire more staff, and if you belong to churches, if you reduce staff or increase staff over the years? Maybe they're stable. But if anything, they grow. But there's this trade-off that kind of helps keep it stable, because if we do more work, then we contribute less money. If we pay more money, you know, do less work. I mean, it's going to come out of our pockets and time and energy one way or the other, which is one reason why a lot of folks, including the people from the asset-based community development movement that we've talked about, we'll talk a little bit more about tomorrow, believe in voluntary associations as a kind of a healthy form, especially for alternative institutions. I don't know if you'll ever be back. You're a computer programmer. Positive feedback loop. Is that a computer programming term?
Feedback loop is positive.
There's positive and negative. Negative cancels out and positive self-reinforces.
Sure.
Tomorrow, church-based action. Thursday, money in markets. Friday, the change clinic. Thanks very much for coming here today.
Thank you.